The impeachment trial of Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich begins today. How's he feeling?
I had a whole bunch of thoughts. Of course, my children and my wife. And then I thought about Mandela, Dr. King, Gandhi, and
the history of the struggle in South Africa is rich with the stories of heroes and heroines.
Mandela, King, Gandhi, and Blagojevich? Well, there's certainly a certain ring to that. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 26th. John Hockenberry is away and Catherine Lanfer is in. It's always a great pleasure to have you, so thanks for being with us.
Hey, it's good to be here, Adora. This hour, we're also going to look at what's coming up in Washington, the latest on Zimbabwe, and the fate of the remaining Guantanamo detainees, plus the 250th birthday of Scottish poet Robert Burns. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
As I mentioned, the impeachment trial for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is set to begin today, but the governor won't be there. He'll be making his case on the morning talk shows instead. On Good Morning America this morning, he said Illinois lawmakers have fixed the case.
What they've done is deny the people of Illinois, who have twice elected me governor, an opportunity to have their governor make his case and defend himself because they chose me. These lawmakers did not.
He said earlier on the show that he considered offering the seat vacated by Barack Obama to Oprah Winfrey.
President Obama is headed to Capitol Hill this week looking for Republican support of his economic stimulus plan. Republican House Leader John Boehner says he wouldn't support the plan without significant changes.
Republicans believe that we have a difficult economy. We believe that we need an economic rescue plan that helps American families and small businesses, and one that will work. And right now, given the concerns that we have over the size of this package and all of the spending in this package, we don't think it's going to work.
The man who would help control all of that money could be confirmed today. The Senate is expected to vote on Treasury Secretary appointee Tim Geithner.
Meanwhile, President Obama is poised to allow states to set their own car emissions regulations. He's expected to make the announcement this morning. At least 14 states, including California, want to impose stricter air pollution standards on new cars. The Bush administration was against it. Pharmaceutical giant Pfizer will acquire its rival Wyeth for $68 billion. The transaction was announced officially this morning. Our partner at the New York Times reported it earlier. They were on the case. It's the first big deal backed by Wall Street in months and the largest merger in almost 2 years. There have been further announcements of large job cuts as the global recession spreads. The electronics group, Philips, says it plans to axe about 6,000 jobs worldwide. The Dutch financial group, ING, is cutting 7,000 jobs after posting a loss of $1.3 billion last year. The average national price of gas is up more than 7 cents. Japan's Nikkei index fell to a three-month low today. It was the only major Asian market open. And today, the Dow starts at 8078 and the S&P kicks off at 832. And we're just wondering, what should or who should Rod Blagojevich be comparing himself to?
Hi, this is Anita from Riverdale. I think that Governor Blagojevich should be compared to Richard Nixon. They both deserve impeachment. Thank you.
So what do you think? 8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are packing in so many issues in just the first days of the week. Timothy Geithner is likely to be approved as Treasury Secretary. The new Senator, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, will be sworn in. And the Senate Appropriations Committee will debate the stimulus bill. And those are just a few things. For a preview, Todd Zwillick of Capitol News Connection joins us. Good morning, Todd.
Hello. Good morning.
Let's start day by day. Now, today you're expecting a full vote on the Tim Geithner nomination to the Treasury Department, right?
That's right. A full vote on the Senate floor this evening, I think around 6, on Tim Geithner's nomination, people probably remember. This one's been dragged on a little bit because of Geithner's tax problems, the problem being that he didn't pay them, or at least some of them, when he was working at the International Monetary Fund. Adora, expect some Republican votes against Geithner. He's going to pass in all likelihood. He will be confirmed tonight in all likelihood. But Republicans have been putting out statements citing various reasons why they'll vote no. Some say they'll vote no because of the tax issues. He just can't lead Treasury and the IRS, by the way, having been warned and then not paid his taxes properly. Others say he's not all that qualified. Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama put out a statement before the weekend saying Geithner was head of the Federal Reserve in New York when all the walls came down. He never warned anybody or did anything about it, so he doesn't think he's all that qualified. So those are a couple of examples, but bottom line, he'll probably pass. He'll probably be Treasury Secretary.
That'll be good news for President Obama as they debate the stimulus package, and we're going to get to that. But let's look at Tuesday. The New York Senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, is scheduled to be sworn in. And are you expecting any controversy there?
No. Why would you say that? Why would the Senate have controversy?
Was that a leading question, Todd? Right. Is that what you're saying?
This one is going to be probably a big relief to everyone, including the Democratic leadership, including Charles Schumer of New York and a member of the Democratic leadership in the Senate. Kirsten Gillibrand will in all likelihood be sworn in on Tuesday and will start to cast her first votes probably on state children's health insurance. That bill is coming back. That'll be her first set of votes on amendments. And let me mention really quickly on SCHIP, which people have heard about before. It's the state children's health insurance program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Congress expanded it last year, or at least tried to, in 2007, I should say. The President Bush vetoed it twice, so the House has already passed their new version. The Senate is passing their version this week. And the interesting thing about it is it has been 8 months, 9 months, or more since Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, has thrown a bill open to all comers. Republican amendments is what I'm talking about. It hasn't happened because his majority was so thin in the last Congress. There were a couple of Republican amendments last week, but what you're going to see this week is a long, open debate where senators, get this for a kicker, can actually come and offer amendments freely and vote on them. That has not happened. It sounds basic. You think that's the way the Senate operates. It's the way it's supposed to operate. This week, Harry Reid has said, anyone who has an amendment, bring it. We'll consider them all for the week. So lots of votes, probably lots of open debate, and probably lots of comments from Republicans saying, wow, look at this. We actually get to vote. It might be a new day. A little bit easier for Harry Reid when he has 58 votes.
So this is new tone that we've heard about, the new way of dealing in a very bipartisan manner.
Well, yes, it is part of the new tone and part of the new bipartisan manner, but as I just mentioned, it's a lot easier to have a new tone and be bipartisan when you have 58 Democratic senators and not 51.
Right.
Right?
It's easy to be gratuitous when you're the one in charge. But let's not forget on Tuesday, there's also hearings on the performance of federal regulators on the Bernie Madoff, the man who was accused of setting up a $50 billion scam.
Right. Hearings in Senate Banking Committee, Chris Dodd's committee. I haven't seen a witness list announced yet. People are interested in the regulators. People are really interested in what happened when the SEC opened Madoff's books, because he was investigated. There were hedge fund managers, competing hedge fund managers on Wall Street complaining about the consistency of his returns, saying it doesn't add up. The SEC was on to him, and they said everything was fine. So senators want to know how that could happen. And that's likely to be the line of questioning there. And then, of course, also Tuesday, there's another big event. We have to talk about the stimulus. We know that.
Oh, yes.
And the president is coming up to the Hill on Tuesday. He's facing a vote in the House on the stimulus this week. That's likely to go fine. But he's coming to lunch on Tuesday to meet with Republicans, not to meet with his own people. He did that a couple weeks ago. His own people are fine with this bill. He's going to sit down and have lunch at the weekly Republican caucus lunch and try to convince Senate Republicans to come on board.
And the president was working overtime this weekend, lobbying and trying to make his case for the stimulus. Let's listen to how he described it.
I've proposed an American recovery and reinvestment plan to immediately jumpstart job creation as well as long-term economic growth. I'm pleased to say that both parties in Congress are already hard at work on this plan, and I hope to sign it into law in less than a month.
And let's listen very quickly to Senator John Boehner, who has essentially already laid down the gauntlet that he's not buying it.
Right now, given the concerns that we have over the size of this package and all of the spending in this package, we don't think it's going to work. And so if it's the plan that I see today, put me down in the no column.
Put him down in the no column, Todd. So how do you think this discussion, this vote, this debate is going to go?
Well, that was Republican leader John Boehner of the House, and the bill's going to go to the House on Wednesday. That's the schedule. Again, because of the wide Democratic margins, close to 80 votes, the bill's going to pass. But as you said earlier, Adora, Obama, the president, has said he wants broad bipartisan support for this bill. He wants buy-in. He wants a huge majority of the Congress to feel bought in, to feel like they're on board, because what's his rhetoric? Everyone's in this together. We have to fix this problem together. He wants that reflected in the vote. Now, here's the Republican leader saying, not so far. But the real test, I think the real test is going to be next week in the Senate. And that's really a part of the big reason why the president's coming up to the Hill this week. Senate Republicans have the votes, if they can stick together, to slow this package down. Actually, they have the votes to kill it. They won't do that. They will pass this bill. But he needs Senate Republicans, and this bill's going to bounce around Congress one or two times before it's finalized. And I think what's at play here is Obama wants to convince as many senators as possible to get on board with the stimulus. They'll have the opportunity for changes. They'll have the opportunity to amend it in the Appropriations Committee. And a strong bipartisan vote in the Senate will put more pressure on the House Republicans to cast yes votes. So Wednesday's vote is the first test of the new president's relationship with congressional Republicans, the first test of how successful he and his people have been at getting this bipartisan buy-in and this new era of cooperation so early in his presidency on this gigantic record-setting bill. So it's important, but it's not going to be the last say. It's going to go to the Senate next week. If the president gets a bipartisan vote there, you know, let's say 78, 80 votes for it, it'll come back to the House in some form, because they're not going to pass the same version.
Yeah, but
and
Todd,
that's where he's – go ahead.
I was just going to say, we're talking about how the bill's going to bounce around, but – look, we have economists saying today that the recession is already going to get worse than we had thought previously. What kind of time do we have for this thing to bounce around?
Well, that's a really good question, Catherine, but it probably won't bounce around for too long. Both Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate, have said President's Day, what is that, February 16th, right in the middle of the month, is their deadline. And they both said if this bill isn't done by then, we're not going home. It's the classic recess vacation threat. So it might bounce around a bit, but for a bill of this size, Congress has never passed a stimulus package this big. And the fact that they're getting it done as quickly as they are so far is unprecedented. We'll see if they get it done that quick. But the threats have been made. The Democratic leaders have said it's getting done by President's Day or else you're not going home. So we'll see if they make good on that and whether they have to.
Well, we're talking about a carrot and a stick here, right? So they're... House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has put down her own gauntlet and said this has to happen by this date. And the other side of this is a real effort, it seems, by President Obama to build new bipartisan relations.
That's exactly right. And those two things are exactly what's going on. And again, it's the first big test of how good the president's bipartisan relations are. He's likely to get a stronger vote in the Senate, and there's more opportunity in the Senate for disgruntled senators. There are a lot of senators unhappy with the package, but they have more opportunity in the Senate to make suggestions, to make amendments, to add what they want, to try to extract some concessions from the Democrats. You guys want a big bipartisan vote? Extend this tax cut. Take this spending for, let's say, new grass on the mall. That's one they've been throwing out there. That talking point. Take that $200 million out.
Todd Zwillick with a preview of what's happening on Capitol Hill, from presidential nominees to new senators and health care for children, and of course, the stimulus plan. We appreciate it, Todd. Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capitol News Connection.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. So today, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich faces an impeachment trial, which could remove him from office. And in the run-up to this trial, he's been comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and to Gandhi. Some people say perhaps he's got a few delusions of grandeur. But we're asking you this. Who should Blagojevich be comparing himself to? And let's say if you were to compare yourself to another historical figure, who would that be? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take on at thetakeaway.org.
Hey, Adore, I want you to listen to a little story.
There was an old saying in the Old West. There was a cowboy who was charged with stealing a horse in town.
And there was a governor in Illinois, as we said, who's about to stand for an impeachment trial.
And some of the other cowboys, especially the guy whose horse was stolen, were very unhappy with that guy. And one of the cowboys said, let's hang him. And the other cowboy said, hold on, before we hang him, let's first give him a fair trial. Then we'll hang him.
Okay. That is, of course, Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich.
It's a hard story to follow,
trial.
I think, Catherine.
Oh, I don't know about that. You know, the trial starts today, but he's not going to be there. He's going to be on a publicity blitz. You've probably heard about it. Appearances on The Today Show, Good Morning America, The View. I cannot wait for The View. And also Larry King Live later today. Amanda Vinicky is going to join us now. She's a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, and she's going to catch us up and also give us a preview of what we're likely to see and hear this week. Amanda, good to have you here.
Thanks so much.
Why is he on TV and not at the State House?
You know, this is very classic Rod Blagojevich. He's always loved the media and being the center of attention more than he has enjoyed being in Springfield. He's known for being uncooperative with the legislature. So this really is nothing new for him. I do think, however, that he is thrilled, I'm sure, to be on The View and Good Morning America, no matter what the circumstances.
All right. Now, his lawyer, he and his lawyer, Edward Jensen, have parted ways. Talk about the implications of that.
You know, Ed Jensen is a very well-known, high-profile criminal attorney who a lot of people said, you know, this guy could actually make some hay. Who knows if it would be enough to truly help Blagojevich in getting off of all of these charges, but nonetheless a very respected attorney. The fact that he quit, I do think, says a lot about Governor Blagojevich himself. Jensen said that he doesn't have to have his clients follow through on the advice that he gives, but they at least have to listen. And I do think, again, what you're seeing here is a very defiant Governor Blagojevich. He takes issue with that word. The governor says defiant isn't what he's doing. He's just maintaining his innocence in the face of all of these fake charges against him. But I think that we're seeing kind of the true character of the governor in the fact that Jensen, again, this guy who has is really very well respected and is known to be in for the fight, being willing to leave.
All right. Now, the wires are lousy with tapes of Blagojevich telling stories, but there are going to be some other tapes that are going to be released that we might hear in the state Senate. Tell us about those.
Yeah, whereas Governor Blagojevich is comparing himself with Jimmy Stewart characters, I think that these tapes, he's not going to sound very much like that. He is using a lot of profanity, as is his wife, who is going to be on The View with him and is known for kind of being dour and sour faced. So we'll see if she puts a smile on for The View this time around. But these tapes are, I think, really going to show not only what the governor has done in terms of abuses of the office, or what senators are looking at as possibly enough abuses of the office, they say, to remove him from office. But I think it's also going to really kind of hurt him, whereas he's trying this public relations blitz. I think you're going to have everybody listening to these tapes and what the governor says on them, and it's not going to help anyone think that he's anything like Jimmy Stewart or Gandhi or Martin Luther King.
Amanda, the bottom line is, are there enough votes to remove him from office? On some level, does this seem preordained, as Governor Blagojevich has claimed?
Yeah, you know, the senators have been very careful to not make any statements to the media. They are doing an effort in this trial to keep the media removed. We have restrictions such as, you know, 15 minutes before the trial begins, we can't talk. We're not going to be able to speak with the prosecutors at all. All of these kind of limits to try and make it fair. But yes, he needs 40 out of 59 votes in the Senate, and I think you will be very hard-pressed. You know, he may get one or two. Who knows? The former Senate president's son has taken over that seat, so maybe, and the former Senate president, Emil Jones, was very close with the governor. Maybe his son will side with his, you know, dad and his dad's ally. Who knows? But yes, there's it would be impossible to get less than the 40 votes that are needed.
How quickly are we going to see action?
You know, everybody's thinking kind of quick, especially now that the governor is boycotting. He and his attorneys, now minus Gensen, are boycotting the trial completely. As I know you said in the introduction, he's not even going to be here today. He's going to be out gallivanting on the media circuit. So without any protests, I think that's going to take out any chances of a prolonged trial. The only exception to that would be there had been a thought that perhaps his legal defense team would try and go to court to put a stop or a temporary halt to the trial. We haven't seen that yet. I think things are going to go full speed ahead and be done as soon as this week.
Well, and in fact, we should also make it clear that there's a possibility, of course, of another trial for Governor Blagojevich. What do we know about his possible criminal trial?
You know, there still has not been an actual indictment. And of course, the governor maintains his innocence in all of this. And he says that there has been a rush to judgment. Got to say that in one regard, there are very few people who I think are believing in his innocence now. So maybe that's true. But I, as a reporter, I guess that's not my place to judge here. But there has been no indictment. We don't know, but I am quite certain that a criminal trial will be coming. And it's not going to focus, I don't think, on just what we have read so far. There were investigations into the Blagojevich administration starting from before he was even sworn in as governor the first time in terms of hiring fraud. So we'll see.
Amanda Vinicky, thanks for joining us. Amanda Vinicky is the State House reporter for WUIS, Illinois Public Radio. And now we're going to turn to Mark Garrison, has the latest for us from the newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine. It's 29 minutes after the hour. A new survey predicts many more layoffs in the next 6 months. This from the National Association for Business Economics. Nearly 40% of forecasters responding predict major job cuts. That's a sharp increase from the fall, and actually the worst numbers recorded since the survey started in 1982. Underscoring that survey's prediction, several global companies are announcing major job cuts today. The Dutch financial group ING says it lost $1.3 billion last year and must cut 7,000 jobs. Philips, the electronics giant, is citing lower demand for its move to cut 6,000 jobs. And one of the world's largest steel companies, Corus, says it will cut 3,500 jobs also because of lower demand. Staying in business, the world's largest drug manufacturing company, Pfizer, is buying rival Wyeth for $68 billion. Pfizer makes big-name drugs like Viagra, Lipitor, and Zoloft. Wyeth has a huge presence in biotech and consumer products like Advil and Robitussin. That is the news. Adora, Catherine.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 26th. John Hockenberry is away, and Catherine Lanfer is with us today. Good to have you. And we've been talking a lot about Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich because today he faces an impeachment trial, and he's been comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and Gandhi. So we wanted to hear from you. Who do you think Blagojevich or anyone else in the news should be compared to?
Good morning, Takeaway. I don't think that Rob Blagojevich should be compared to Jesus or Muhammad or Buddha, but I do think that Illinois should coin its own money and they should print, "In Rod We Trust" on it.
Well, there's a thought, and we want to hear yours. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
All right, Adora. Moving on to some more somber developments. This morning, leaders in South Africa have been told they must stop supporting Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe or that they would be complicit in a, quote, "passive genocide," end of quote. That was the message from Catholic bishops in the region. Also this morning, the European Union has extended sanctions on Mugabe and his supporters. You might recall that President Mugabe's party, the ZANU-PF, the ZANU-PF, and the opposition party, which is called the Movement for Democratic Change, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, signed a power-sharing agreement last September, but they've been unable to agree on the formation of an inclusive government. Earlier today, we spoke with BBC correspondent Jonah Fisher. And when we spoke, I asked Jonah, given the disappointing track record for progress in the region, is there any possibility that this latest summit is actually going to change anything in Zimbabwe?
Well, this is the fourth time that the heads of state of Southern Africa have met since disputed elections in March of last year. And really, expectations for this particular summit are lower than they've ever been. Usually, the leaders who come to these summits talk up the possibility of a deal, talk up the possibility of somehow broaching that difference between ZANU-PF, Robert Mugabe's party, and the opposition MDC. This time, there's really none of that. I think there's a real acknowledgement just how far the two sides are apart in terms of who will have what power in a power-sharing government. And this is really Southern Africa's last attempt to try and solve Zimbabwe's problems before it gets referred to what's likely to be a summit of the whole of Africa this weekend in Ethiopia.
Can we talk for a minute about the cholera epidemic? Because it seems to be the sort of physical manifestation of the stalemate that we have in Zimbabwe.
Well, Zimbabwe is in a state of collapse. There hasn't really been an effective government since those elections in March of last year. So everything really is collapsing. Schools were supposed to go back today. They're not going back because the teachers aren't being paid. The health system has collapsed, and we're seeing the direct consequences of that in terms of this cholera epidemic, which has killed nearly 2,800 people, many of them who've come across here into South Africa looking for treatment. So without any form of real effective government in place, Zimbabwe's infrastructure has collapsed, its currency has collapsed, and that's why Southern Africa has tried hard to take an interest, but so far has really failed to put any form of meaningful government in place in Zimbabwe to tackle its many problems.
So, Jonah, there have been these numerous public declarations of how they're going to resolve this stalemate. What are they saying behind the scenes? What is it really going to take in order to take Zimbabwe one step further? Because as you noted previously at one of the summits, there was this great hope last year that with this power-sharing government that Zimbabwe might be able to turn the page and start moving forward. What now?
Well, you're right. There was that brief surge of optimism in September last year when this power-sharing deal was signed. But since then, I think grim realism has set in, the acknowledgement that Robert Mugabe doesn't really want to share power, that he's only willing to have the opposition in his government as a junior partner and not to give them any meaningful authority. So in the short term, that there are these options like it being referred to the African Union. Perhaps Robert Mugabe will try and form his own government without the opposition being involved. Perhaps even Morgan Tsvangirai will somehow be persuaded that a junior role is the way forward. But I think in the longer term, most people who watch Zimbabwe closely would say elections will probably be the way that Southern Africa and Zimbabwe tries to get out of this crisis. And then the real question will be, can Zimbabwe somehow hold elections in a way that will satisfy the opposition, that they can take part without their supporters being attacked by supporters of Robert Mugabe?
What's at stake for South Africa here?
Well, Zimbabwe has really become a domestic issue for South Africa. People have been crossing the border in their hundreds every day. People who are sick with cholera coming to South Africa looking for treatment. There are millions of Zimbabweans who work here in South Africa and send the money back home to Zimbabwe to keep their families going. So it is a domestic issue here. And if anybody can have any influence on Robert Mugabe, it's generally thought that Southern Africa, the president of South Africa, Halema Motlanthe, would be that one person. person. But so far, there's really been no sign from the South Africans that they're going to take a stronger role. They simply talk about trying to push this power-sharing government forward, even though all the discussions that we've seen at the moment don't suggest that this power-sharing government is going to work.
And out of curiosity, is there any sense that President Obama might have greater interest in this story than, say, the Bush administration did? And what kind of influence do you think potentially the U.S. could have?
Well, as yet, we've seen very little from the Obama administration to suggest that Zimbabwe will be near their list of priorities, let alone top priorities. And we've seen so many times in the past Britain, the United States, Western countries making strong statements about Zimbabwe. And really all that does is increase Robert Mugabe's rhetoric. He regards this as just another way to beat the opposition, if you like, to say, look, your supporters in the West, your supporters in the United States are supporting you, are telling you what to do. That's why I should stay in power in Zimbabwe, because if you put the opposition in power, you're simply getting the West in place, and this will be a new colonial period for Zimbabwe.
That's Jonah Fisher, BBC correspondent, who spoke to us from South Africa in an interview conducted earlier this morning. And now we're going to turn to Mark Garrison with the latest headlines.
Thank you, Catherine. It's 39 minutes after the hour. Minnesota's Senate saga turns another page today as a three-judge panel.
I'm like, that story's not over yet.
No, we got some time. We need some kind of Senate drama. Like, you know, we filled New York, so let's have a little Senate action in Minnesota. But essentially, a three-judge panel will hear today what could be a weeks or months-long case to decide who actually won the race. The judges are picking up Republican Norm Coleman's lawsuit over a recount that puts Democrat Al Franken ahead. But legal experts say Franken's 225 vote is going to be a big challenge to overcome. Coleman's argument is that ballot irregularities and improperly rejected absentee ballots account for the narrow lead that Franken has. Kirsten Gillibrand will be sworn in tomorrow as New York's junior senator. She had lunch yesterday with the woman she's replacing. That would be Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, of course. Senator Charles Schumer, also, and New York Governor David Paterson were there for the lunch. Gillibrand says she plans to hit the ground running. The former Congolese rebel leader Thomas Lubanga has entered a plea of not guilty to war crimes charges at the start of the first ever trial before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Lubanga is accused of conscripting children under the age of 15 into his rebel movement, which controlled part of the Congo earlier this decade. Also, fresh data out on a story closely followed by parents. A new study basically refutes the charge that thimerosal, this is a preservative in vaccines, was linked to autism. This is the latest study, a long-term study, and they say that proves in their sense a lack of a link between thimerosal and autism.
Serious debate there. Thanks, okay. Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Adoree Udoji. Let's listen. Over the weekend, some people marked the 250th anniversary of the birth of renowned Scottish poet Robert Burns. So you think you never heard of him? Okay, how about Auld Lang Syne as we're listening? The eternal New Year's Day song, that's Robert Burns. David Stenhouse, a radio producer for our partners, the BBC, is an expert on Burns. He produced a 2004 documentary, and he's in the studio with us here. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
So what were the celebrations like this weekend? A big deal in Scotland, huh?
They were a big deal in Scotland, but also all around the world, because the thing about Scots is we're everywhere. So in our little house in the East Village, my wife and I had some haggis and neeps and tatties.
Oh, yummy, haggis.
Did you bring any?
It's illegal to bring any, so I can't answer that question, because the American Food and Drug Administration view that haggis is unfit for human consumption. And what that means is that American haggis, because there are some sort of Scottish butchers here who valiantly make it, to my palate tastes a bit like hot chicken liver pate, which is not quite the point. Because all the good stuff, the heart and the lungs, you're not allowed to eat here.
Right. And that sounds like quite a celebration. But let's talk about Robert Burns. You talk about how he brings in $300 million to the Scottish economy every year. Why is that?
Well, the thing about Burns is he's celebrated every year in a kind of little formula called the Burns Supper, where, you know, there's each at each stage of the Burns Supper, money is spent. You need to hire a kilt, because not all Scotsmen have kilts all the time. You need to buy bottles of, you need to buy bottles of whiskey, which is pretty pricey. You need to buy your haggis, if you can buy your haggis, if you're in a country that allows a haggis. And so each year there is money spent. And so, as you say, I made this programme, and it worked out that Burns brings in, it's actually £157.25 million each, depending on
roughly
the exchange
roughly $300 million.
This year, Burns is even bigger, because 2009 is the year of homecoming in Scotland, and Robert Burns has been used to head that up, because aside from Sean Connery, he's probably the world's most famous Scotsman.
Well, let's talk about why he's so famous. I mean, he died when he was 37 years old, but he accomplished a lot in that period of time. Tell us about his poetry and his music and whatnot.
Sure. Well, it's never a bad career move to die young. So he's like the sort of he's
so
like the
noted.
Jimmy Dean of Scottish poetry. He was also. You know, Burns is the kind of guy who every Scottish man wants to be and every Scottish woman wants to be with, because not only was he an intellectual, he was a kind of working man. He fathered 12 legitimate children and...
12.
12. And goodness knows how many on the other side of the bed, as it were, other side of the sheets. he wrote during his life an extraordinary range of poetry. There were the comic poems, there were the political poems, there were the love poems. And so, you know, Scots have got a ready vocabulary available to them at all times, whether they want to, you know, seduce a beautiful woman, make a joke, make a political comment. There is a Burns poem available. And as you say, all around the world, every Hogmanay, New Year's Eve, everyone sings Auld Lang Syne.
Well, thank you very much, David Stenhouse. I have a whole new appreciation for Robert Burns and his other side of the bed mannerisms. Thank you. David Stenhouse is a BBC radio producer who did a 2004 documentary on Robert Burns, the author and creator of this song. Let's listen.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 26th. John Hockenberry is away. Catherine Lanfer is in for him. So welcome, Catherine.
Hey, good to be here.
And we also have Mark Garrison here, who's got the headlines. He's sitting in for Femi Okeh.
Thank you, Adora. It's 48 minutes after the hour. Pfizer, the world's largest drug maker, will pay $68 billion to acquire its rival, Wyeth. They announced the deal this morning. The news comes as Pfizer plans to cut 10% of its workforce. Both companies are under financial pressure. Patents for some of their top drugs will expire soon. President Obama's focus is on the economy this week, among other things. He'll be appealing to Republican lawmakers for support of his stimulus plan. Democrats hold majorities, but the president still wants to pass it with Republican votes. Treasury Secretary appointee Tim Geithner is expected to be confirmed tonight. The vote was delayed when senators learned that Geithner failed to pay some of his federal taxes earlier this decade. He has since paid up on back taxes. A Virginia federal appeals court is holding a hearing on whether or not to hold a new trial for a man who pleaded guilty to helping plan the September 11 attacks. Zacharias Moussaoui was sentenced to life in prison, but his lawyers say court-imposed secrecy kept him from presenting an adequate defense. They say his plea should be thrown out and a new trial granted. The Screen Actors Guild Awards were given out last night. Heath Ledger won the Supporting Actor Award posthumously for his performance in The Dark Knight. His co-star Gary Oldman accepted on his behalf.
He was an extraordinary young man with an extraordinary talent.
Ledger died a year ago of an accidental drug overdose. He drew a standing ovation from his fellow actors. He won a Golden Globe earlier this month and was nominated for an Oscar last week. SAG winners are sometimes predictive, and so Heath Ledger, again, continues to be the heavy favorite to get a posthumous Best Supporting Actor nod in the Academy Awards as well.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Sure.
Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich, we've been talking a lot about him today, and he's been comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and Gandhi. And so we've been asking, who do you think Blagojevich should compare himself to?
If Rob Blagojevich was in a movie, nobody would believe that his character was real.
Well, there you go. There's a thought, too. Give us who you think Blagojevich should be compared to, or maybe who he should not be compared to. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Many in the U.S. and all over the world were looking forward to President Obama keeping his campaign promise to shut down the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. But new reports in the New York Times, our partners, and by the Jamestown Foundation point to the complexities involved. Both are reports about former Gitmo detainees rejoining the ranks of al-Qaeda. And there are some reports just this morning that authorities in Saudi Arabia have arrested 9 Islamist militants, including former inmates of the Guantanamo detention center. So we'll be looking for more details on that. In the meantime, we have invited Gregory Johnson, terrorism analyst with the Jamestown Foundation, to our show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's take a look at what's happened in just the past week. There was certainly some suggestion by the Bush administration that it was very difficult to release those detainees that they thought perhaps could be dangerous. Is this exactly what they were talking about? Some evidence over the weekend of a former detainee on video now linked to an al-Qaeda group in Yemen?
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that they were worried about. And I think the fact that you have to keep in mind is that the people in Guantanamo who are sorting through this evidence, you often don't have a very good grasp on what it is that these people may have done. You just have kind of rumors and half-truths, and it's very, very difficult to sort out fact from fiction.
So up till now, how was it decided which detainees were released and which have been held at Guantanamo? There were nearly 700, and now we're down roughly to around 250.
Right. Well, in the Saudi case, which is what's gained the most news over the past week, it was something where the U.S. and Saudi Arabia came to an agreement where Saudi had set up this rehabilitation program that they really had put a lot of money and a lot of energy into, and the U.S. Bought off on this and thought of it as a way to really get rid of most of the Saudi detainees. So over the past few years, they've shipped 109 Saudis back to Saudi Arabia.
And Gregory, what does that rehabilitation program look like, particularly when you balance it against maybe several years of incarceration?
Right. Well, it's much different, of course, than Guantanamo Bay. So the Saudi prisoners get on a plane, they fly back, they meet their families, they're taken to kind of a halfway house where then they undergo some religious re-education with state-approved imams and other religious leaders. They do a number of different things. There's even things such as art therapy courses where they go and they try to get some of their aggression out through painting and things of that nature.
Yeah, but Gregory, how long is that when you stack up against years of imprisonment?
Well, this is the problem that we're coming up against now. So most of the Saudi detainees who have went through this program have been kind of the easiest cases to solve. And so it appears that we might be reaching a point where the benefits of the Saudi program, we're going to run into something of a bit of a diminishing returns as more and more kind of hardcore detainees start to go through this program. And obviously with the case of the 2 detainees who've now rejoined al-Qaeda in leadership roles, it shows that it's quite easy to pull the wool over people's eyes.
Exactly. Let's talk about Ali al-Shahiri, 35 years old. He was released from the Guantanamo Bay in November 2007, and now he is allegedly the deputy leader of al-Qaeda's Yemen group.
That's correct. And one of the things I think that's quite worrying both for the U.S. as well as for countries in the Arabian Peninsula is that this seems to suggest a much more regional reach for al-Qaeda in Yemen. That is, they're going to be looking to carry out attacks both in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, as well as the Horn of Africa. So it's really a quite worrying development on the security front.
And Gregory, doesn't it also highlight the very convoluted and complicated and just full of gray areas that now the Obama administration is going to have to confront as he makes good on this promise to shut down Guantanamo Bay in the next year?
Absolutely. As I said, there's a lot of kind of mixture of fact and fiction, and so it's really going to be incredibly difficult, I think, for the people that the Obama administration has sorting through these files to determine, especially with these in-between detainees, the detainees that U.S. intelligence agencies feel are dangerous, but that the U.S. government currently doesn't possess enough evidence or legally obtained evidence with which to convict them in court. So trying to sort out exactly who to release, what to do with the people that you can't release, is going to become incredibly, incredibly difficult. And I think that the likelihood of seeing more cases, such as we saw with al-Shehri, is quite high.
And what do you think they must focus on most importantly?
Well, I think one of the most important things that they need to do is they need to have experts with regional expertise, with the requisite language skills, in order to go through this evidence, because there's a lot, as someone like myself reads through even the declassified documents, you can kind of get a picture of these individuals. So there's one individual who's now a Yemeni, who's going into his seventh year of detention in Guantanamo, who in the transcripts appears quite confused. He doesn't know what it is that they mean by al-Qaeda. He keeps saying that he's from a different city, because in Yemen there's a city called al-Qaeda, and he believes that they're accusing him of being someone from this city. And so he's obviously quite disoriented and unsure of what's going on. So you have individuals like that, as well as individuals like al-Shehri and others who, when released, go back to al-Qaeda. So it's an incredibly difficult thing to sort all of this out.
I mean, you're really talking about two tracks then. The first track is the 250 or so who are left at Guantanamo Bay. How do those cases get disposed of, whether some of them are charged or not? And then you've got the second track, which is to take a look at where those detainees are who have already been released and what they are up to.
Right, and the detainees that have already been released, it's incredibly difficult to keep a handle on their movement. As you saw, neither the U.S. intelligence agencies nor the Saudi intelligence agencies really had a good hand on al-Shehri before he appeared in this video last week.
Terrorism analyst Gregory Johnson of the Jamestown Foundation, we thank you, and I'm sure we're going to be speaking to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Jamestown Foundation is a global think tank on terrorism-related issues. And, of course, we're always on here at The Takeaway, and we've been talking a lot about Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich because, among many things, he's been comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and to Gandhi. And many of you have had very strong reactions to this, thinking perhaps Blagojevich should compare himself to someone else.
The governor appears to be very much like Mohammed Saeed al-Sahaf, who you may remember from the Iraqi invasion of 2003 as the wildly delusional information minister, Baghdad Bob.
I'm sure you probably remember him. He was the former information minister of Iraq, and he was standing at news conferences saying that there was no bombing happening in Baghdad. And meanwhile, the walls were shaking and his hands were shaking. Anyhow, there's a comparison for you. What do you think? Who should Blagojevich be comparing himself to? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought for a takeaway today.
It's a lot easier to have a new tone and be bipartisan when you have 58 Democratic senators and not 51.
It's easy to be gratuitous when you're in charge, right?
I guess so. Those are words to live by.
Yes. Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection, he was talking about Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and how it's easier for him to sound bipartisan when he's got a big majority. We're always on, and if you missed anything like our interview with Todd Zwillick, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Adore Udoji. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
President Barack Obama's stimulus package is up to bat this week, but Senator John Boehner doesn't like what he's heard so far.
There's a $2 trillion hole in our economy this year. Government can't fix this. We can't borrow and spend our way back to prosperity.
Okay, then. We hold the world ransom for $100 billion.
Watch out. It's going to be quite a fight this week on Capitol Hill. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
morning. It's Monday, January 26th. John Hockenberry is away. Catherine Landfer is in, and it's always a great pleasure to have you, Catherine.
Oh, thank you so much, Adora. In this hour, we also look at a presidential move towards stricter auto emission standards, the growing political power of Latinos, and we celebrate the Chinese New Year, which begins today, the Year of the Ox. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
It's the first full week in office for President Barack Obama, and fixing the economy, as you can imagine, is high on his to-do list. He'll be on Capitol Hill this week to rouse Republican support of his economic stimulus plan. House Minority Leader John Boehner says there isn't much out there yet.
Right now, given the concerns that we have over the size of this package and all of the spending in this package, we don't think it's going to work.
A House vote on the package is expected Wednesday. House Democrats have a large enough majority to pass it without Republican backing. But President Obama wants bipartisan support for the $825 billion bill. Tomorrow, he could have a new cabinet member helping him make the case. The Senate is expected to vote on the Treasury Secretary appointee, Tim Geithner, tonight.
But first, the president will focus on the energy crisis. He's expected to make an announcement later this morning that allows states to set their own car emission regulations. At least 14 states, including California, want to impose stricter air pollution standards on new cars. Oprah, a senator, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich said today on Good Morning America that he considered her for President Barack Obama's vacated seat.
The idea came to me from a friend, and then among the considerations we discussed whether or not it made any sense. She seemed to be someone who had helped Barack Obama in a significant way become president. She was obviously someone with a much broader bully pulpit than other senators.
You're right. The governor's been making the talk show rounds this morning, Adora. He's boycotting his impeachment trial set to begin today. He says the case is fixed and he's going to refuse to take part.
Meanwhile, Pfizer, the world's largest drug maker, will acquire its rival Wyeth for $68 billion. The news comes as Pfizer plans to cut 10% of its workforce. Both companies are under financial pressure. Patents for some of their top drugs will soon expire. Pfizer's not the only big company cutting jobs. Electronics group's Philips says it plans to slash about 6,000 jobs. Meanwhile, the Dutch financial group ING is cutting 7,000 positions. Today, the Dow starts at 8078 and the S&P kicks off at 8:32. Governor Blagojevich thinks he of Mandela and Gandhi. Well, what do you think of when you think of him?
Well, my name is Tom Lang, and I'm calling from Epsom, New Hampshire. And I'd like to compare Blagojevich to that other well-known guy who wanted to get some money, Judas.
Wow. So what do you think?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's going to be a busy week, too, for President Barack Obama. He's got nominees to get confirmed. He's also got the stimulus package on the agenda. And there's clearly going to be much debate about that, the $825 billion stimulus package. But there is still the question of the bank bailout, an effort to continue to stabilize the financial markets. Some people have used the word bank nationalization. David Sanger joins us to outline the issue. He's the chief Washington correspondent for our partners at The New York Times. And he's also the author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Dora. Good to be back with you.
So outline the debate that is going on right now about what to do now about the banking system.
Well, here's the issue, Dora. First, the first part of the banking bailout effort stabilized some of the banks, but failed to achieve the major objective, which was to get lending going again. The money went in to secure the capital base of the banks, but the banks did not then turn around and lend it out, which meant that there was no way to sort of restart the housing market, other elements of the economy that depend on lending. So the first question is, how do you force the banks to lend when it seems to the banks to be against their own interest, because what they're trying to do is shore up their capital. And the last thing they want to do is lend more of that out, especially if they think some of the lending might turn bad as the economy turns down. So you get into this sort of vicious cycle. How do you break the cycle? One option is to nationalize the bank, something that, you know, barely rolls off the tongues of Americans. It sounds like something
right.
the French do, right?
Exactly.
The second option is to basically cut off all of the bad loans, or many of the worst of the toxic loans, and pour them into something called a bad bank.
And that was the initial idea that many thought that Secretary Paulson under the Bush administration was indeed going to do.
Well, it's got some problems. The first problem is this is exactly what we told the Asians not to do during the Asian crisis. Why is that? Because you set all the wrong incentives into the system. You're basically telling banks, that's okay. If you lend wildly to people who shouldn't be borrowing money to begin with, and you get stuck with bad debt, don't worry about it. The American taxpayers are willing to sit out here with a couple $100 billion of their own money and make your shareholders good.
Well, in fact, talking about the taxpayers, what do they get if we nationalize the banks?
That's the thing. In nationalization, at least you get stock in the bank. And if times turn better, the banks improve, then you could turn around and sell that back into the private market. And the theory, remember, a few months ago when Paulson and others would step out and say, don't worry, if this works right, it's not actually going to cost the taxpayers anything. We're going to lend them this money, and then we're going to sell off our shares and or our interest in this and make money back. And that's what happened in the Mexican bailout and even some of the Asian bailouts. We actually did make money on it. That discussion seems to have gone away.
Why?
Well, here's why. If you do the bad bank theory, then you're taking the worst of the bank loans, but you're not really getting much of a share in the banks itself. So you have nothing to sell off if things turn better. You're just left with the dreck. Okay, that's number one. If you do the nationalization, you do have the shares to sell back, but you're stuck with it for, you know, until that market turns back. The other thing is, the people in the Obama administration believe, and I think they're probably right on this, that governments historically make lousy bank managers. Mm.
Well, I was just going to say, if governments run the banks, talk about the political pressure they're going to be under,
huge,
with that money.
You're the senator from pick a state, Michigan, Illinois, Hawaii, any place you want. Okay, you've got a whole bunch of bad mortgages. You've got some big institutions about to go under. Maybe you've got a major city or two getting ready to go bankrupt. Suddenly, the government owns Citigroup or Bank of America, and you're making that backroom call to the Treasury saying, gee, sure would be good if you guys could step in and lend them just a bit for a while. And suddenly you're lending, or you're under pressure to lend, mm-hmm. for political reasons instead of for good business reasons.
Well, there's certainly no lack of issues or obstacles to confront as the Obama administration takes a look at the banking industry. And I'm certain also, David, they're going to be taking a look at what's happening in England, in the United Kingdom, as they essentially nationalize most of the banks. David Sanger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Sanger is chief Washington correspondent for our partners at the New York Times, and he's also author of The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. Catherine?
Adora, more than 10 million Hispanic voters turned out on Election Day, and they voted overwhelmingly for Barack Obama. He received twice as many Latino votes as John McCain. And now that Latinos have pushed the lever in the voting booth, can they push for more power in the Obama administration? We're going to get a forecast on that from Jibby Martinez. She is a longtime Washington observer and a contributor to Politico. Jibby, thanks for joining us this morning. Cool.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what gap do you see between the actual power of the Latino vote and the perception of it?
Well, the Latino vote clearly is there. They showed their presence in November, as you said. The question is whether they can continue to push their agenda now that the new administration is there. And one of the things that we see in official Washington and the political elite is that there seems to be less consideration for the Hispanic caucus than, say, for the Black caucus. You know, one could argue that, you know, Barack Obama is an African-American and therefore is going to be more inclined to listen to the Black caucus. But it really is just a raw perception of power. The individual members of the Hispanic caucus are indeed powerful. They have risen to leadership positions in the House and Senate. There are chairs of committees in the House. And yet, when you look at the caucus as a whole, it hasn't learned yet how to flex that collective muscle. And that's what they need to learn in order to get the attention. And we just heard David Sanger talking about, you know, the banking situation. You know, the Hispanics are disproportionately hurt by issues like the economy. You look at housing foreclosures, they're going to have a higher percentage of housing foreclosures in their areas. You look at education, they're going to have poorer schools in their areas. So there clearly is a need for Hispanics to flex the muscle, and the question is whether they will and can this year.
Okay, so what gets in the way of that? I mean, it's hard to imagine 10 million, a voters' block of 10 million having to struggle for recognition.
Yeah, to some extent, it's interesting because I think it's the caucus itself. You know, the policy leaders, the leaders of the civil rights groups and the Hispanic community are very savvy. They're the ones who got the vote out, organized the vote, raised the money to do these, you know, public service announcements in the neighborhoods to get the vote out. They did a very good job in the fall. The caucus itself has not yet learned how to organize a message or a strategy, and also is kind of haunted by ghosts of past divisions. 2 years ago, at the beginning of the last Congress, there was a big fight in the caucus between the male members and the female members. It was a gender fight. And it caused two members of Congress, two sisters from California, Loretta Linda Sanchez, to resign from the caucus. This year, Linda Sanchez has come back, but Loretta Sanchez has not decided whether to rejoin the caucus. When you have those kinds of petty, you know, bitter, nasty fights internally, it's going to be hard to work together. And they need to learn to get beyond that and basically to mature and to grow up.
So in other words, Jibby, you're arguing that the full power of this particular group, this political group, is not going to be realized until they work out some of the kinks among leadership.
Right. And, you know, they have a woman, Nidia Velasquez of New York, who is their new chair this year. And so they're hoping that they can sort of regroup under her leadership. One of the things about her, though, is that she is very much of a backroom player, very gritty, determined, behind-the-scenes player. She's the chair of the Small Business Committee, which is important to the Hispanic community. But she is. People are still waiting to see if she knows how to marshal all of the forces as a political, you know, strength. One example, when Bill Richardson, the New Mexico governor, withdrew as Commerce Secretary, individual members sent letters to the Obama transition team saying, okay, even though we lost that Hispanic seat in the cabinet right now, we still want to have a Hispanic. Richardson is out, but we still want a Hispanic. That's something that the caucus should have done collectively. It would have been helpful if they had, you know, gotten together around a message and transmitted that to the Obama transition to say, look, you almost broke a record in having three Hispanics at the cabinet level. That's unprecedented. You know, aim for that. Try to do that. Repeat that. But it doesn't look like he's going to. And
okay.
That kind of shows the lack of power, power outage among the caucus.
So many other issues we could get to, especially, of course, immigration. We know it's going to be a key issue. Jibby Martinez, hope to talk to you further about this. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is Jibby Martinez. She's a longtime observer of Washington and a contributor to Politico. You're listening to The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good Good morning. As Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich got ready for his impeachment trial that begins today, you might have heard him over the weekend comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and to Gandhi. Well, many people thought that that was a bit of delusion, and so they've been telling us what they think, who they think Blagojevich should actually be comparing himself to.
Hi, this is Paul from Atlantic Islands. I compare Rob Blagojevich to Pee Wee Herman, and he's about to fall out of his playhouse.
I'm trying to use the phone!
That would be Pee Wee Herman. What historical figure should Blagojevich or anyone else in the news be compared to? It's kind of a low blow, huh? Pee Wee Herman, what do you think, Catherine?
Oh, man. He's trying to use the phone!
Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry, who's away today. But what do you think? Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And now we're going to take a look at how President Barack Obama may be influencing people. Many people said that his election was a perfect example of a role model succeeding in America. Many heralded this election as a role model achievement for all Americans. And specifically, a group of researchers have begun trying to understand and measure the effect of Obama's success on African Americans. Ray Friedman is a management professor at Vanderbilt University, who is a sociologist and has studied the perception of racial differences in organizations. And he joins us now. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. I got to tell you, I'm a little skeptical about this, and so I'm hoping that you're going to turn me around. Isn't it too early to potentially measure the effect of Barack Obama's ascension to the presidency of the United States? How did you set up this study?
Well, what we did is we were looking at test-taking. We set up an experiment. We had a set of black and white respondents take a subset of a GRE test. And they did it at four points in time, one before Obama was nominated, one right after the nomination speech, then halfway towards the election, and then right after he was elected. And we were able to compare at each point in time what the differences were between black and white responses, number of correct answers on this mini GRE test, to see if there was a difference in black-white differences in score over time.
And so what did you find?
Well, to understand it, I probably need to explain the background behind it. To begin with, there's an effect called the stereotype threat effect. And that is where if you look at blacks taking tests or women taking math tests, there's often a concern that there's a stereotype about our group saying that we can't do well. And so if you take the test under a situation where they know you're looking at if they're black, white, or if they're male or female, mm-hmm. that can create anxiety, reducing the performance on test taking. So something as simple as asking at the beginning of a test, are you black, white, Asian, will be a signal to people that you're looking at their race. And under prior tests, we know that when you do that, test scores for black subjects in these experiments have been reduced.
So how does that relate to this study about Barack Obama and as to whether or not he's a role model?
Well, we know that if you have a role model in the room when they're taking the tests, if you have, for example, an advanced PhD student who's black in mathematics at Harvard walking in the room and giving that test, that reduction in test performance goes away. And so our question was whether this has been done with people walking into the testing room, but we were not sure whether someone like Obama, who's a bit more distant, who's far away, who's mm-hmm. not in the room itself, would actually have an effect because he's so much in the news. We were hoping to see an effect, but we weren't quite sure. What we found is that if you, prior to Obama being highly prominent right after the nomination speech, there was about a 3-question difference between black and whites in this test that we did under conditions of stereotype threat. Then, right after the convention speech, among those who watched the speech, that black-white difference virtually disappeared. Then, halfway towards the election, the difference reappeared. So there was, again, a spread of about 3-question differences. But then, right after the election, when, again, he was very, very, very prominent, as we all know, the difference disappeared. So if we look over time in our 4 points of taking the test, those 2 times where he was giving an historic speech, where a lot of people were watching him, everyone was paying attention, he was on everyone's mind, those were the times where we saw a reduction of the stereotype threat effect.
You know, I just have to ask, so does this mean that if you tested women right now on math, they do better because Hillary Clinton's our Secretary of State?
Well, I don't know if she quite has as much prominence or as much focus. If you think about Obama, he certainly had prominence for the last 2 years. It's not like he wasn't prominent all along. But there were a few points in time where everyone was looking at his speech and saying, this is historic. It was being played over and over again. And certainly when he was elected president, that was a major event different than what effect he had 2 weeks prior to that. You know, certainly there might be an effect of Hillary Clinton, but, you know, being elected president, I think, is a level above that.
But how do you account, Professor, for example, Barack Obama has been in the headlines long before the last 2 years, and for African-Americans who are paying attention to their national leadership, he was certainly on their minds then over the ensuing years. So how do you differentiate between just this general admiration of him and the specific ascendancy to the presidency?
Well, you know, when we began the study, we weren't sure whether an effect, something like an Obama effect, had already happened fully. And so we could have had a situation where our first round of testing already closed the gap and there was no gap and we would have found no difference over time. But there is, you know, a lot of the world is not as tuned into politics as some people. I'm very aware of politics, and I'm sure you are too.
Right.
But there's a real spread of attention that people pay to the political world. So it's a difference between having, you know, a lot of people interested in him and proud of him, but then at other points in time where every single person is really, really paying attention to him. And also, once he's elected, there's really proof positive that the world has accepted him and that he has fully accomplished everything you'd hope. Prior to that point, you never quite knew. I mean, he was certainly prominent, but hadn't completely proven himself.
And I'm sure that you're not going to be the last researcher to take a look. Ray Friedman, we appreciate your insight today. Ray Friedman is a management professor at Vanderbilt University who is a sociologist and has studied the perception of racial differences in organizations. Now we're going to get some quick headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you. A new survey just out today predicts more major layoffs are coming in the next 6 months. And as if on cue, several companies around the globe announced big cuts today. Construction equipment maker Caterpillar among the biggest, eliminating 20,000 jobs. Sprint Nextel says it will shed 8,000 jobs by the end of March. The Dutch financial group ING is cutting 7,000 after big losses. In Iceland, the prime minister says the country's financial crisis has caused the nation's coalition government to collapse. Talks between the partners broke down. The prime minister will next speak to the president and formally dissolve the government. That is the news.
Thanks very much, Mark. We'll give you more time next time.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's January 26th and it's Monday, and Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is facing an impeachment trial today, and he's been comparing himself as he prepares for this trial to Nelson Mandela and Gandhi. And we've been asking you, who do you think Blagojevich should be comparing himself to, because some people have taken issue with that. And here's a riddle from one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Dan Smith from Springfield, New Jersey. The governor of Illinois reminds me of two politicians, actually. One who had 18 minutes of missing tape, and the other one who looked in the face of America on TV and said, I did not have sexual relationships with that woman.
Catherine Lanford, who's in for John Hockenberry today. Who's he talking about? Maybe he's talking about Richard Nixon with the 18-and-a-half-minute tapes missing, and Bill Clinton with the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Exactly.
We want to hear from you. What historical figure or popular culture figure do you think Blagojevich should really be comparing himself to? Or maybe if you were to compare yourself with one of those figures, which one would it be? Give us a call, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We're moving on to President Obama and and his administration, which continues to quickly reverse some of the Bush administration policies, from everything from Guantanamo Bay to reproductive rights. This morning, the president is expected to give California officials the power to restrict greenhouse gas emissions from cars, a standard already adopted by more than a dozen other states, or I should say more than a dozen states also want to adopt very similar procedures. And Peter Baker from our partners at the New York Times has been covering the story, and he joins us from Washington. Good morning. Always great to have you, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
Can you lay out the power that the president is now handing over to California?
Well, what he's going to do today is actually he's going to start a process that will presumably end in that result, exactly, that California would get the ability to set a different emission standard for cars that are sold in California. 13 other states want the exact same power, have signed on to the same application along with California. The Bush administration rejected this in December 2007. It said it had just increased fuel efficiency standards nationwide, and to have some states do it one way and other states do it a different way would be too onerous on the auto industry. But what President-elect Obama, now I guess is going to do is he's going to tell the EPA to reconsider that decision by the Bush administration. And if in fact it does reverse what Bush did, you'll see about half the states or half the people in the country in those 14, 17 states, depending on how you count them, now apply this tougher standard. In effect, that would probably make the nationwide standard equivalent to what California has set, because automakers aren't going to try to make two different types of cars.
And let's get to the details of how this program has worked in other states. But first, how does the Obama administration address the issues put forth by the struggling automakers? I mean, we all know that the automakers have just been on the verge of absolute collapse. They have argued that complying with these new rules will cost them billions and billions of dollars.
Well, that's right, exactly. And one of the things that Obama and his team have insisted as they've talked about bailout money for the auto industry is there is a price to be paid for that. If you're going to take federal money to save your automaker, automaking companies and retrofit them, let's go ahead and use that as a way of forcing them to meet new conditions and reorganize the way they do business to make it a more energy and environmentally friendly operation.
So how hard has it been then for the automakers to deal with the rules that have been set up in those 13 states that you describe?
Well, those 13 states have applied to do the same thing as California. In other words, they're all at this point wanting to move their standards
up. I see.
At the moment, we have one standard across the country. If, in fact, California's application were ultimately approved, which is definitely what's going to seems to be the result of what today's action, you'll see those 13 states, and apparently three other states want to join as well, all of them move up to this higher standard that would force, you know, a car to reach a certain miles per hour earlier and sooner than the national standards would.
Okay, let's weigh the costs or the concerns that, like, say, the automakers have against what the environment gains by creating this standard of how much emissions can be sent out by cars in any particular area.
Well, that's the real question, and it's a good one. We're looking forward, I think, today to hearing more from the automakers and their advocates to hear what they think would be the consequence of this. Obviously, at a time when they're facing, you know, the question of their very survival, their argument, I presume, will be don't add additional burdens to us. Don't try to do optional things at a time when we may not be able to survive. You know, what the Obama administration is going to say is this is exactly the moment to re-engineer the auto industry, you know, at a time when we're trying to figure out what its role in society is. Part of that has to consider the broader good in their view of energy consumption and the environment.
Well, President Obama is clearly making good on his promises to address some of these environmental issues. I'm assuming that advocates are going to be thrilled about this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, some of the environmental advocates are saying already that this combined with his order to the Department of Transportation he's going to issue today to go ahead and put out interim nationwide fuel efficiency standards for 2011, that he'll have done more for fighting climate change in 1 week than Bush did in 8 years. That's probably a bit of hyperbole, but at the same time...
Really? You think,
that,
Peter?
Well, it does suggest that they are happy with this administration
right.
And they want to, to be supportive of it, and they are very frustrated with the Bush administration, fairly or unfairly.
Peter Baker. Always good to hear from you, sir. Peter Baker is a reporter for our partners at the New York Times, and he was laying out what the Obama administration is up to today. And environmentalists are thrilled about some legislation that he's going to sign about fuel efficiency. And there you go. Mark Arison is here with the headlines.
Thank you, Adora. It's 39 minutes after the hour, and it's a multi-billion-dollar drug deal coming out this morning. The world's largest drug company, Pfizer, is buying rival Wyeth for $68 billion. Pfizer is responsible for big-name drugs like Viagra, Lipitor, and Zoloft. Wyeth has a huge presence in biotech drugs and over-the-counter products like Advil or Robitussin. A federal appeals court in Virginia is scheduled to hear arguments for a new trial by September 11th conspirator Zakarias Moussaoui. He was sentenced to life in prison after pleading guilty to helping plan the attacks. His lawyers now say he could not present an adequate defense because of secrecy rules imposed by the court. Today in Pretoria, South Africa, African leaders are meeting to make yet another attempt to resolve the political deadlock in Zimbabwe. At the same time, Europe is tightening sanctions against President Robert Mugabe. EU foreign ministers slapped sanctions on more than 60 Zimbabwe citizens and companies linked to Mugabe. A string of suspicious fires in a Philadelphia suburb has prompted a warning from authorities. Officials say residents should remove flammable materials from porches and keep lights on at night. The latest fire left dozens of people homeless. Coatesville, Pennsylvania officials have declared a state of emergency. Investigators think gang activity may be to blame. Lawyers for record producer Phil Spector will try an unusual strategy when they open their defense phase of the second murder trial today. They'll be trying to show that he didn't just threaten women with guns, he threatened men as well. Spector is accused in the death of actress Lana Clarkson nearly 6 years ago. The first case ended in a mistrial when jurors could not reach a unanimous verdict. Now, Paul Bart Mall Cop may have been the number one, but also if you look a little further down on the box office numbers, you see some interesting activity, kind of movies getting a bump from Oscar nominations. So Slumdog Millionaire, been out for a while, but now it's moving up, cracking the top five, made $10.6 million over the weekend. Also, movies like Frost Nixon, up 350%, The Wrestler, Revolutionary Road, Rachel Getting Married. You know, Oscar buzz is kind of worth something, so it's interesting to watch.
It seems like Slumdog Millionaire is going to be tough to beat in the Oscars.
It's a favorite, certainly.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Adora Udoji. We have some news today out of Sri Lanka. Sri Lankan forces are on a major offensive aimed at crushing the Tamil Tigers and ending their fight for a separate state. But Tamil rebels are still saying that they're not going to give up. Here's one politician from the opposition side.
We are not going to accept any solution the government comes up with. The Tamil-speaking people must have the right to internal self-determination in the areas of their historical habitation. That's our fundamental human right, and nobody can deny that to us.
Earlier today, we spoke with BBC correspondent Anna Barasan Edirajan, and he was reporting from Colombo. We asked him to give us a sense of what's happening.
Heavy fighting is continuing in the northern part of Sri Lanka. Both the Tamil Tiger rebels and security forces are fighting with each other in many areas of northeastern part of Sri Lanka. And this fighting, the latest fighting, comes just a day after the army said it had captured the last major rebel-held town of Mullaitivu in the northeastern part of Sri Lanka. And as you're aware, the Tamil Tigers have been fighting for a separate state for the ethnic minority Tamils in this country.
Anbarasan, obviously the fighting has been going on for a very long time. What makes this particular battle significant?
Because the army now says they have driven away, they have dislodged the rebels from most part of northern eastern part of the country. And now they have boxed them in a triangle-shaped territory in the northeastern part of the country. Just to give you an idea, a couple of years ago, the Tamil Tigers were controlling nearly 10,000 square kilometers of territory. Now the army says they control only less than 400 square kilometers of territory. The war has been going on for the last 2 years, and the army says now they are in a final battle to give a crushing blow to Tamil Tiger rebels, and that's why this assumes significance.
What have we heard from the rebels so far? I mean, we're hearing a lot from the government about this battle, but what are the rebels saying?
So far, the Tamil Tigers have not reacted to this army's claim about capturing this important town of Mullaitivu in the northeast. But of late, pro-rebel websites have been talking about civilian casualties. What they were Of course, they were accusing the Sri Lankan army of shelling into civilian areas, a claim strongly denied by the army. But a short while ago, in fact, just 2 minutes before I came on air, I spoke to one of the UN officials, and he had confirmed that dozens of civilians had been killed and injured in the fighting over the weekend. But of course, they put the blame on both the warring sides. This is the concern for the aid agencies, because there are more than 230,000 civilians in the area.
So then, quickly, is this a welcome development to the people of Sri Lanka, or is the concerns about the populations more significant to them?
As far as the majority Sinhalese is concerned, this is a welcome development because they want to see an end to this ethnic conflict. As far as many Tamil people are concerned, well, winning the war doesn't mean that the government can achieve peace, because what they want is a political solution, and they say only a political solution can give a lasting peace.
We hear that in so many regions. Political solution, achieving lasting peace. Thank you very much. That's Anbarasan Edirajan. He is a BBC reporter, and he was coming to us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. We talked to him earlier this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Mark Garrison is filling in for Femme OK on this Monday, January 26th, and he's got headlines for us.
Thanks, Adora. It's coming up on 48 minutes after the hour. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is steering clear of his impeachment trial today. He says it's rigged and he won't show up. He's making the case on TV talk shows instead, including The View and Larry King. As you know, Blagojevich is accused of attempting to sell President Obama's vacant Senate seat. Future governors won't have that opportunity if Senator Russ Feingold has his way. He's proposing a constitutional amendment that would take away state governors' power to appoint a senator. He wants to require special elections in every state. Fresh data this morning on a story closely followed by parents, a new study is out about the long-term effects of thimerosal. That's the mercury-based preservative that used to be common in children's vaccines. It adds to a mountain of evidence that there is a no link between the preservative and autism. The study was able to look back at thousands of Italian children who were given two different amounts of thimerosal in vaccines. We've talked before on The Takeaway about the financial crisis in Iceland. The economic collapse in October has now led to a government collapse. Talks broke down between parties of the coalition government. That means the prime minister's cabinet is resigning, and he will formally dissolve the government. The government had been under strain for several months. The Screen Actors Guild Awards were last night. They're closely watched as predictors of the Academy Awards. About a fifth of the Academy Award voters are actors, so they carry a lot of weight on those votes. So Slumdog Millionaire fans can actually take heart at the results. The film won the Best Ensemble Cast Award. Anil Kapoor plays the game show host, and he dedicated the statue to the children in the movie. These are first-time actors hand-picked from Mumbai's poorest areas.
They deserve this award. They set our performances. It's the children who have done it, not us. So this is on behalf of the children. Thank you very much.
Slumdog doing well in the awards, also at the box office. Last weekend, it got into the top five. And that's the news.
Thanks for that, Mark. I didn't realize that they had used some children from Mumbai.
Yeah.
Good to know. Thanks very much, Mark. And we've been talking a lot today about Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich as he faces impeachment, an impeachment trial today. And he's been comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and Gandhi, and that has annoyed, insulted some folks. One of our listeners emailed us to say, Governor Rod Blagojevich should definitely be compared to Alfred E. Newman of Mad Magazine fame. What, me? Worry? So what do you think? Who should Blagojevich be comparing himself to? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Okay, Adora. Now, you know, today marks the beginning of the Chinese New Year. According to the lunar calendar, it is the year of the ox. Now, the ox, as you might know, represents perseverance, patience, balance, hard work, all things we're going to need for the year ahead. But we wondered what foods would pair well with the symbolism of the ox, because that is a huge part of the celebration of the new year. Well, to help us answer that question and to give us a real taste of the Chinese New Year is Eddie Chan. Eddie is a catering manager at the Sweet and Tart restaurants in New York, and he's brought in some food for us to try. He's put it closer to Adora. Now,
I like that.
I know this is a really busy time for you, Eddie, so we were lucky to get you it all this morning. Talk about why food is so key to the Lunar New Year.
Thank you for having me, first of all.
Yes.
It has been really busy. A lot of Lunar New Year parties at this time of year. And a lot of what we do is we cater and host parties for families that come together at this time of year. And
that's a key part of the New Year's Eve celebration,
yeah.
Right?
Much like gatherings and Thanksgiving or Christmas, where there's a big meal at the center of it all. And what's interesting is that a lot of these dishes that we have during Chinese New Year's, the significance in them really is really in the name or in the name of the ingredients used.
Give me an example of what you have over there closer to
Sure.
Adora.
Okay, so what I have here is a dried oyster and black moss seaweed dish,
All right. Which
is pretty traditional. It's one of the more, I guess, auspicious dishes that we have during this time of year. It's very...
black oyster. So that
dried
means
oysters.
A dried oyster.
With black moss seaweed, yes.
Okay. And what is it about the seaweed that's supposed to connote something?
Yes. Okay, well, the name of this dish in Cantonese is Fa Choi Ho Si. Okay, so that's sort of a punny play on the actual words or the characters used for the ingredients, actually. So Fa Choi is actually the word for seaweed, the seaweed used.
Right.
But it's a play, the name itself, Fa Choi, is the play on it, and that's prosperity.
Oh.
So it's got a very similar sounding
So
name.
We're talking about puns that taste good.
And that
yes.
has to do with the Year of the Ox specifically, right?
No, it doesn't. I struggled a bit to find something very specific to the Year of the Ox. And I'm sure there are. It's just in the hurry trying to prepare dishes, we came across what's readily available and readily kind of made popular year after year, regardless of what year it is. And there are these dishes that are pretty
What is the Year of the Ox, though? There's some particular meaning to that as opposed to the Year of the Monkey or the Year of the Goat.
Yeah. And I think Catherine touched on that. And each animal in the zodiac symbolizes a different thing. And,
so yeah. the ox, it's supposed to be steady. You know, it
yes.
pulls the plow along. It helps the earth give us these gifts.
Got it.
Right, so in other words, mellow, right, as compared to some of the other animals that are there for the choice.
Kind of. The rock kind of.
Okay, now the oyster, the dried oyster. I think Adora should taste one of those. I'll pay for that later.
Yeah, okay.
Let's talk some more about the lucky food.
Sure.
I see shrimp over
yes,
there?
Yes, you do.
Okay, what is with that shrimp?
Okay, so this shrimp dish, it's shrimp and water chestnuts, water chestnuts. And again, a play on the name.
Yeah, see, that she'll go for. I like
My
that.
Hand
that
is out.
Yeah, no one could see that. The little hand came out.
Okay
so the shrimp and the water chestnut. What's the pun here? What's the homonym?
Not so much a pun, yeah. really. More.
Oh, stop it.
More metaphorical, even mm-hmm. allegorical, kind of. It's the name for that is Long Ma Jing San.
Yes.
In Chinese. And Long is the character for dragon, and that's symbolized or represented by the shrimp. Usually it's a lobster. Okay, but here we have shrimp representing
Hey, you know,
it.
It's a recession. Yeah, you got to cut
go.
Back.
Thank
it
you.
It is
so much.
Absolutely yummy.
Oh, thank you so
yummy.
Much.
Please yummy. Yummy.
And ma tai is the word for water chestnut. And the word ma symbolizes horse. So you have the dragon and a horse, and that's sort of like the vivacity of the two animals, and that's what this dish represents.
Okay, and it also helps people sort of wish for what they want in the year ahead, right? You eat your wishes, as it were.
Yeah, it's like a well-wishing, this naming of these dishes.
Okay, yeah. And so what else? Do we have anything else over there?
We do. We have a rice pudding cake here. And this is
now
also
that says
really
breakfast to me. Okay.
It does breakfast dessert. It for either. It's called Ningou, and that literally translates to year cake, if you will. But there's another.
I think that should be every year, the year of the cake.
Actually, the year of the cupcake is what I'm gunning for. But go ahead.
There is a punny name for it. It's called a bo bo gosing, and what that really means, another well wishing, is that kind of a step by step advancement in your career, and it has that significance. So, yeah.
Now there's many days actually to the celebration.
There are, yes.
So what's coming up, say, today or tomorrow?
Well, today is the day.
Today's the New Year.
I know tomorrow has some significance as well, the 2nd, as well as the 7th. I don't know exactly why there are significance.
So tonight, all over the world, as it were, you know, depending on when night falls, families are going to be gathering together. What's going to be the one thing you know will probably be on every table, or they'll try to have it?
Definitely the rice cake. That's pretty common. It's easy to make. In fact, I mean, it's a whole day-long celebration versus just getting together for a meal tonight. It probably started way early in the morning, just like kids would open Christmas presents.
Right.
They await their red envelopes with, you know, lucky money.
Oh, Eddie Chan, we could go on and on. I want to wish you a very prosperous Year of the Ox. That is Eddie Chan, catering manager of the Sweet and Tart Restaurants in New York, talking about the Chinese New Year, Adora.
Hey, Catherine, I like that idea of lucky money. What do you think?
Yeah, money's usually lucky for me.
Well, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is not feeling so lucky today as his impeachment trial begins. He's been comparing himself to Nelson Mandela and Gandhi and offending some folks. And we've been asking, what do you think about that? And who do you think Blagojevich should really be comparing himself to? Richard emailed us to say, Governor Blago reminds me of Mayor Quimby, the corrupt and bumbling mayor of Springfield on The Simpsons.
Well, we'll just see about that. Let's go to town hall. Fine!
That's The Simpsons' Mayor Quimby talking to Chief Wiggum. What historical figure should Blagojevich or anyone else in the news be compared to, do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your thought on a takeaway today.
There clearly is a need for Hispanics to flex the muscle, and the question is whether they will and can this year.
That's Jibby Martinez, Politico contributor, talking about how more than 10 million Latino voters can translate that vote into influence in the Obama administration. And I don't know, we thought we'd give you a second takeaway for this morning.
The people in the Obama administration believe, and I think they're probably right on this, that governments historically make lousy bank managers.
Well, that's David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. I'm Adora Udoji. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Great fun today, Catherine.
Hey, thank you.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You are tampering with forces you can't understand.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.